Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Jay Truman of the Downwinders Foundation, who analyzes the disputes which have led to rising tensions and the potential for nuclear conflict between India and Pakistan. Mark Weisbrot of the Center for Economic and Policy Research, who discusses the role of the International Monetary Fund in Argentina's recent economic collapse. And Reverend Eric Smith of the New Haven Reparations Coalition, who examines Yale University's involvement in perpetuating the slave trade. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Just days after the September 11th terrorist attacks, the Federal Communications Commission, led by Chairman Michael Powell, a fan of free markets, started a complete review of the federal rule that limits the number of local newspaper and broadcast outlets that a single media giant can own. According to the Media Watch Group, Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, the FCC rule on cross-ownership has been in doubt for months, ever since the Washington, D.C. Federal Court of Appeals rejected an FCC rule that prevents cable TV companies from owning more than 30% of the American pay TV market. The FCC, under Powell, declined to appeal the ruling. Now the FCC is accepting public comment on the need for the cross-ownership restriction. The FCC is looking to see if the cross-ownership rule, in effect since 1975, is still needed to protect diversity of viewpoints, look at the impact of the Internet on news and information, and the possible benefits of joint operations of newspapers with radio and TV stations. The Center for Digital Democracy, a public interest group, says ownership limits are vital to protecting media diversity and to place solid controls on media consolidation. Evident in the $47 billion purchase of AT&T's broadband unit by Comcast. In the near future, big cable companies like Comcast or AOL Time Warner are expected to be the entry point for broadband service. With fewer large cable companies, only a handful of media moguls will dominate cyberspace, which critics fear will diminish media diversity. The Nation magazine reports that the United States Department of Energy, in charge of America's nuclear weapons complex, is going to great lengths to avoid a thorough environmental cleanup of the Rocky Flats bomb-making plant. For over 50 years, Rocky Flats, located just 16 miles outside of Denver, built the plutonium core for nuclear warheads. Now, the DOE is confronted with the huge cost of cleaning up Rocky Flats. The first plan was to scoop up all the radioactive soil and try to isolate it. The soil will remain dangerous for the next 24,000 years, the time that plutonium remains radioactive. To lower costs, the DOE has come up with a new plan to make Rocky Flats a wildlife preserve, which would only require a minimal cleanup of the site. Arjun Makhijani of the Maryland-based Institute of Energy and Environmental Research blasts the DOE plan, which will require less cleanup than the U.S. government conducted at the Johnson Atoll nuclear test site in the Pacific Ocean. Still, Rocky Flats has radioactive levels 40 times higher than the test site. In the wake of mounting public opposition, the DOE is reconsidering its cleanup options for Rocky Flats. A new set of proposals is expected to be released in early 2002. Ever since 1998, when Pfizer introduced Viagra to boost sexual performance in men, major drug companies have wanted to create a similar drug for women. According to recent medical studies, 43% of adult women suffer from sexual dysfunction as opposed to 31% of men. The Federal Food and Drug Administration currently defines sexual dysfunction as decreased sexual desire, lessened sexual arousal, or failure to climax. The FDA has already approved one topically applied drug called Eros, manufactured by the Minnesota-based Urometrics, which currently is only available by prescription. According to the Progressive magazine, there are several sexually enhancing drugs in the works, but despite a huge market potential, many feminists and sex writers are skeptical about the prospect of a female Viagra drug. For most feminists, the question is not chemistry, but poor self-esteem and women trapped in bad relationships. Sex therapist Carol Ellison feels that many women will be frustrated with the new drugs because their low sexual desire is caused by stress and an insensitive partner. Women need to stop asking themselves, "What is wrong with me?" but need to take charge of their lives and not look to drugs to improve sexual performance. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.
For the fourth time in 50 years, India and Pakistan are edging closer to war. Tensions rose shortly after a Kashmiri separatist group launched a December 13th suicide attack against India's parliament that killed 14 people. The leaders of both nations traded verbal attacks, followed by a dangerous buildup of troops along their shared 2,000-mile-long border. India's leaders charged that Pakistan has failed to rein in terrorist groups, which are believed to have been behind the December parliament attack and an earlier October 1st assault on India's Srinagar legislature. Both India and Pakistan possess nuclear weapons, a fact that alarms many observers who note that the two nations have fought three wars since their founding in 1947. The spark that ignited previous conflicts has been the five-decade-long dispute over the territories of Jammu and Kashmir, a mountainous region that both nations claim as their own. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Jay Truman, founder and director of Downwinders, a research foundation that works to end nuclear weapons testing and reduce the threat of atomic warfare. Truman discusses the danger of war between India and Pakistan and the historical context which has led to the current conflict.
Basically, India and Pakistan have had three wars since they were created as independent nations in 1947, when the British Empire fell apart. The hot spot between them has traditionally been Kashmir, which is the only predominantly Muslim state of India. And there's been fights there for Kashmir to become independent. Pakistan has supported extremist groups in Pakistan who have been waging a war of independence against India since 1988. And in that period of time, somewhere between 50,000 and 80,000 people have died. Originally, when it was split up, Kashmir was going to be an independent nation. It became fearful of Pakistan and ceded itself to India, and Pakistan promptly invaded, and that was the first war. And basically, they're still at the ceasefire line where that war ended in 1948. The United Nations has called for a referendum three times to determine, so the people in Kashmir can determine what they want to do, and it's never been held.
Why is that? What's the obstacle to that referendum?
India feels that it was ceded to India by its ruler legitimately in the first place, and they have no intention of giving it up.
Now, maybe you could speak to the U.S. war in Afghanistan and how that may have triggered off this recent round of attacks. How has that contributed to the increasing tensions in your view?
Well, in one way, it has told the Indian government that there's a double standard here, that we traded a condemnation of terrorist activities and nuclear policies and a lot of other things we didn't like with Pakistan for Pakistan's allowing us to use some of its facilities and to use its airspace and to cooperate with us and at the same time to basically look the other way about what was going on with these other groups that the Pakistan Intelligence Agency was supporting. And that, of course, set the Indians off. Then you have what's been going on with those fundamentalists in Kashmir is the same has been going on with the Taliban. It's all part of the same thing. So when they get attacked, they're mad at Pakistan. So one way of getting back at Pakistan is to create problems with India for the Pakistan government.
Now, both these nations possess nuclear weapons, and it probably is the most dangerous place on the planet for the possible start of a nuclear conflict of some kind. What, in your view, is the danger of a nuclear conflict between these two powers?
The danger is extreme. Both countries have made threats about them. There's also the main danger I see, even probably greater than their use, is that this is a no-win situation for the government of Pakistan. And eventually that government is not going to survive this one way or the other. And where those weapons end up, Pakistan's weapons end up, could be extremely dangerous for the rest of the world.
Well, as we close out, Jay Truman, tell us your best prescription for settling this issue between Pakistan and India and how the U.S. could immediately take a leadership role in solving this long, festering problem.
Well, I think a couple of things the United States could do, and that is to ask its friends, which we are friends now, China and Russia, to join it in offering to mediate this situation. and to do so fairly and evenly without taking sides. That's one thing. Number two, I think we're going to have to face the fact that we cannot do anything right now to antagonize the situation inside of Pakistan. Doing something like hot pursuit across the Afghan-Pakistani border, chasing Osama bin Laden, for instance, right now would not be a wise thing to do, especially when his supporters can very easily pull off more terrorist attacks and ensure that India will go to war against Pakistan. We need to deal with this situation because it is the most dangerous situation out there today.
How does the situation between Pakistan and India illuminate for us the need for a global cessation of this nuclear arms race?
Because if we and the other nuclear powers had been serious in wanting to come to agreements to end the arms race, India would never have gone ahead and developed its own nuclear weapons and conducted its last rounds of tests in 1998. India made it very plain in 1996 that unless the PERM 5, as it called, and that's the five other nuclear powers, but unless they committed themselves to a timetable to do away with nuclear weapons, they were not going to sign the test ban, and they were going to go ahead and develop their own nuclear option if they had to. And we refused, and they did. And then Pakistan followed suit. This shows what happens if there is not going to be an end to the arms race.
That was Jay Truman, founder and director of the Downwinders Foundation. Contact Downwinders by calling area code 208-776-5903 or visit their website at www.downwinders.org. As Argentina's economy imploded, riots and protests engulfed the nation's cities, including the capital, Buenos Aires. With more than 25 protesters killed and hundreds injured in the unrest, President Fernando de la Rúa, along with his economic advisors, resigned shortly after his government declared a state of siege. But with record unemployment, deepening poverty, and a shrinking middle class, confidence in any new government will be slow in coming. In recent decades, Argentina has suffered through a brutal military dictatorship and a political culture rife with corruption. According to many economists, the South American country was plunged into economic chaos as a direct result of flawed advice from the International Monetary Fund. The IMF had maintained support for Argentina's 1991 policy that pegged the value of their currency, the peso, directly to the U.S. dollar. A policy which in the end made Argentina's exports extremely expensive and its imports very cheap. The country now is burdened by a $155 billion foreign debt. The new Peronis government has continued to limit personal bank withdrawals and announced plans to issue a new currency, the Argentino. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Mark Weisbrot, co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research, who discusses the role of the IMF in Argentina's economic collapse and the global movement that has been campaigning to restructure the powerful financial institution.
Well, the big thing is their overvalued currency. They fixed their currency to the dollar, one peso to $1, exchanges for $1. They did that in 1991. And for a while, this was okay. But after a few years, the dollar became overvalued. And as a result, when you have a situation like that where your currency is overvalued, first of all, you have a trade balance problem because your exports are too expensive and your imports are too cheap. But even worse than that is when investors begin to think that the currency is going to fall, they start demanding very high interest rates. And so the interest rates for your whole economy go way up. And that's what's kept Argentina from recovering from this recession.
Could you explain the role of the International Monetary Fund in sort of perpetuating this one Argentinian peso for the dollar and how they maybe should have seen the writing on the wall a lot sooner?
Yes, well, they had a very important role in perpetuating the problem because they put up the money. If you want to have a fixed exchange rate like this, you have to have a dollar for everybody who wants a peso. You have to be willing to, you have to have the dollars to exchange that. And of course, as more and more people lose faith in the currency, more and more people start cashing in. And so you need more and more dollars to give them to exchange pesos. And so the IMF stood there ready to do that. In fact, arranged enormous loans in the last couple of years, especially in order to prop up this currency. And so that was their role. And then they did worse than that, too, because as the economy continued to stagnate and shrink even, they came in and said, well, you got to balance your budget now. And, of course, you don't want to have to balance your federal budget during a recession. We don't do that because your tax revenues are falling during a recession and your expenses very often increase because more people are unemployed. You've got over 20% unemployment in Argentina now. So that was bad advice, and that made the situation a lot worse, too, because it worsened the recession and it got people very angry. And it also kind of sets up a benchmark for the financial markets. You know, they say, well, we need a zero deficit. And so then when the financial markets see that the Argentina can't cut its budget because they're already throwing too many people out of work, then that creates even more instability. So they pretty much made all the serious mistakes that you could make in a situation like this.
What does the crisis in Argentina say about the policies that the International Monetary Fund and World Bank have exercised over the last couple of decades? Are people within these institutions taking another look at how they guide these nations?
I don't think there's a lot of rethinking going on. They'll rethink the narrow question of the exchange rate, and they'll probably not support fixed exchange rates anymore with this kind of money. Your bigger question is what does this show? Argentina was the poster child of their whole experiment in opening up these economies and privatizing what they call neoliberalism in Latin America. And it's failed miserably, not just in Argentina, but the whole continent, you know, has only grown about 7% per person over the last 20 years, for the whole 20-year period, not per year, which, you know, if you compare that to the previous 20 years, 1960 to 1980, where they grew at 75%, that's quite a difference. And that's really how it looks in most of the low- and middle-income countries, really throughout the world. You see the same thing. The last 20 years have been an economic failure, even on the most narrow indicator, but a very important indicator, but the one that economists, you know, recognize doesn't measure everything, is growth. And even on growth, it's failed. And, of course, it's failed if you look at, and we did this, too, at the Center for Economic Policy Research. We looked at social indicators, life expectancy, infant mortality, education, literacy, and all the major social indicators. Most of the low- and middle-income countries, their progress has slowed down over the last 20 years, which is what you would expect when the economy doesn't perform nearly as well as it used to.
How does the Argentinian crisis figure in with the critique that's been gaining momentum over the last few years by a growing global social justice movement that has, in particular, targeted the policies of the IMF and World Bank?
Well, it's pretty much what they've been saying. Here's these institutions that can't get the policies right, and they have way too much power. I mean, this is the real problem, I think, that most people have attacked. It's they have a creditors cartel. The IMF is at the top, and if the government doesn't do what the IMF tells them, then they don't get money from, in most cases, the World Bank, and they don't get it from the Inter-American Development Bank or other multilateral institutions or the governments of the G7 countries or even very often the private sector. So that's what happens, and this is the kind of result that you get. I think even if they did have the best interests of these countries at heart, which they often don't, they wouldn't really be competent to be making economic policy. And you can see this in the case of Argentina. I mean, the question of, you know, what to do about your exchange rate is a fundamental question of international finance, and it's not easy. It's very country-specific. There are trade-offs, and for some countries, you know, a fixed exchange rate might still work. Like China, for example, has a fixed exchange rate, and it's worked for them. But, you see, they have a whole different set of policies that go along with that. They really shouldn't be making these decisions, but they insist on it, and that's the real problem.
That was Mark Weisbrot, co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research. Contact the center by calling area code 202-292-5380 or visit their website at www.cepr.org. Over the past year, the issue of reparations for slavery has resonated in both national and international forums, including the United Nations Conference Against Racism held in Durban, South Africa. In New Haven, Connecticut, a local group took up the issue last spring after the city's Board of Aldermen held a forum on the reparations issue. The group, the New Haven Reparations Coalition, proposed a strategy to research the subject. But that plan was eclipsed by revelations made by three Yale University graduate students detailing Yale's role in perpetuating slavery and racism. Among the facts that the students uncovered was that of Yale's 10 undergraduate residential colleges named for individuals, 9 were named after proponents of slavery, including many whose financial contributions to Yale resulted directly from their owning or trading in slaves. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhu spoke with Reverend Eric Smith, pastor of Community Baptist Church in New Haven, and a spokesperson for the Reparations Coalition, about his group's work and what its members are demanding Yale do to make amends for its past treatment of African Americans.
It was suggested during the public hearing that New Haven create a local task force that would look at the role that New Haven-based institutions played during slavery. So we started convening meetings and had 4 or 5 sessions where we actually did formulate a plan and formulate a proposal that the Board of Aldermen are now going to consider.
What are the components of that proposal?
Essentially, we're asking that the city create a task force made up of people who don't live in the city of New Haven, preferably historians, economists, that kind of thing, and have them research the role that the top 5 employers, including the city administration, played during the days of slavery, seeing if they utilized slave labor in terms of their activities, if they named any facilities after slaves, if they did business with companies down south that did business with slaves, and just to find out any kind of way if they profited from the slave trade.
What are those 5 companies?
We haven't identified them. What we're going to do is trust that the historians will do that. I mean, obviously, we knew that Yale University would be at the top of the list. We expect probably the city administration will have a role.
When 3 graduate students at Yale produced this recent document that showed Yale's connection with slavery and its acknowledgement and honoring of many people who had dealings with slavery in its naming of the residential colleges and an endowed professorships and so on. What was your response to that, or your group's response?
It was essentially, and you got to understand that I'm a minister, it was hallelujah time, frankly speaking, because that literally got released about 5 days after we announced what we were forming. And it was funny that one of the alderpersons who opposes this said that this is going to turn into a witch hunt, and I don't think that they're going to find many witches. Then all of a sudden the report comes out, and we've landed a big witch, so to speak. So we were happy to see that our work was going to bear some fruit. It caused us to rethink our strategy. Our original approach was to just focus on making the case for reparations, and then after the case had been made, start to see what form it could take. Given the fact that this report strongly makes the case in terms of Yale, we've now had to rethink and start creating a structure for reparations. So it was helpful in that respect, and it has now put some structure to our thoughts around reparations.
There was a report recently that pointed out several specific things that I guess your group is suggesting or asking or demanding that Yale do. Can you talk about those a little bit?
Sure. First, to set the context, the Freedmen's Bureau at the end of the Civil War was created to kind of help get freed slaves acculturated into American culture. So their work focused on land, economic opportunity, education, and civil rights. So those 4 areas, based on that historical precedent, becomes the framework for reparations. As it relates to land, we're asking that Yale rename the residential colleges that are named after people with a pro-slavery mindset, after abolitionists from their history. We're also asking them to expand their home buyer program to include African-American first-time home buyers who buy homes in the empowerment zone. under the economic opportunity piece, we're asking them to create an economic development fund so that African-American-owned profit and nonprofit businesses can apply for no-interest loans and for grants. Around education, we're asking them to create a Simeon Jocelyn Scholarship Fund so that New Haven High School graduates can apply for scholarships and get scholarships to go to the college of their choice. Simeon Jocelyn was a pastor of Dixwell Congregational Church. He sought to start an African-American college for African-American slaves and freed. And what happened is that Yale-affiliated officials essentially crushed that effort. They brought it to a complete halt, and as a result, you did not have an African-American institution of higher learning for approximately another 20 to 30 years. And then in the area of civil rights, we're asking them to remove the name of master from the head name of the heads of the residential colleges, and we're asking them to enter into negotiations, so to speak, around creating a social contract with the greater New Haven community. And that'll involve them dealing with their patents with the age of drug Xeret. That will involve the percentage of minorities they currently have employed at Yale at higher levels, and that will involve increasing the percentage of minorities who are dealing with other contracts at Yale.
Some people, when they talk about reparations for slavery, think about individual payments to descendants of slaves. What this group is talking about seems fundamentally different, or how would you put it in context with that proposal?
It goes, given the fact that the slave trade impacted the African-American community in total, it doesn't seem realistic to just narrowly sit back and say that the slave trade just impacted descendants of slaves. So on that theory alone, it needs to be broadened to encompass the entire African-American community. So it was never considered that a direct payout be made to individual African-Americans who were descendants of slaves. If we create this larger reshaping of the economic framework, it'll impact the African-American community overall. So that's what we really want to do, impact the community overall, not just set African-Americans.
That was Reverend Eric Smith of the New Haven Reparations Coalition. For more information, call area code 203-562-7060 or visit the group's website at www.yaleslavery.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced by WPKN Radio's Public Affairs and News Departments. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, or would like a cassette copy of today's program, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756, or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. You can also visit our website at www.btlonline.org. Our theme music was written and performed by Mikita. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Anna Manzo, Harry Minot, Denise Manzari, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Archibald Kirk.